Welcome to another edition of The Front Page. I'm your host, Chuck Moraz. Today we're talking to Rowan County Chief Deputy Joe Klein. Joe, as always, we appreciate your time and thanks for coming over.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Chuck.
We've had a chance to talk a number of times about the drug problem in this region and in particular in Rowan County. And I know that we've also discussed the fact that it's become an epidemic over recent years.
Yes, that's what we've referred to it as since I've been with the sheriff's office.
You've headed up Operation Rowan Roundup, the anti-drug sweep effort, since its inception back in 2010. And I know that you've netted, I think, at least over 200 arrests and 200 indictments, I guess, as part of this. So, I mean, do you feel like it's been pretty successful?
Yes, I think we have been successful with this round roundup, as it's been titled. Of course, we still got a lot of work to do. We feel like we are making a difference out here. Are we stopping it? Absolutely not. And we didn't go with that intent because we knew how deep and how wide this is. It is a major issue. It's affecting so many people. We've just titled it. It's an epidemic of drug overdoses. Now we're seeing that, and it's a societal issue, as we talked about. It's not just a law enforcement issue. It's not just a education school issue. It's everybody's issue, and everybody needs to be on board with this.
And this operation has changed over the years. I know back in 2010, when it was initiated, the focus was on stopping the illegal distribution of prescription pills. But now, since you've been able to kind of put a damper on that, it's moved to heroin. I mean, it's like whack-a-mole in a way.
It is. Of course, we knew from the information that we were receiving through intelligence gathering, it's through our investigation, that heroin was at the door. When you start heavily enforcing the pill issue, the pill epidemic that we've had, we knew we were making a difference when you can raise the price of pills on the street. That was the feedback we received. When we started, a 30 milligram oxycodone or oxycodone was $30 a gram. You know, in a few years into it, when we started our enforcement efforts, to the real push, we saw the price of a pill on the street went from $30 to $50. Well, the price of that is when you raise the price of pills on the street, then there's always another market of some type of other drug getting ready to come in. Of course, you know, the way it's been described and explained to me through training is, you know, these hydrocodone, oxycodone, they're all synthetic heroines, what it boils down to. Well, when you raise the price of pills to a certain extent, then you can bring the powdered form in illegally, of course, and sell it at a cheaper dosage and flood the market with that. And it'll be widely received, widely accepted, but along comes, you know, with heroin, you've come with needle use, hepatitis. My understanding is off the charts in this area, so it's a major issue to deal with. When you look at one thing, it may be a problem, but it just snowballs into other issues that we're dealing with.
And it kind of leads me into another question. You talk about the use of dirty needles, and hepatitis is now spreading because of it, in addition to drug addiction. I think that some counties have gone to what they call a needle exchange program for addicts. They can come in anonymously, turn in their old dirty needles, and get fresh ones. You support such a program here in Rowan County?
I don't know if that's something that would work or not, Chuck. I don't know, you know, as far as, you know, putting my belief or my feeling, what I've seen over the years with this enforcement, especially when this heroin started flowing in. That's not a mindset of what addicts that I've interviewed and I've talked to. That's not a mindset to go exchange a needle. That's not what they're thinking about. They're thinking about when, where, and how am I going to get my next dosage.
So, in other words, you're saying that they don't even think about a needle exchange program. They're just worried about the next fix. So it might not even work anyway.
Exactly. That's the experience I've had with the addicts that I've talked to. And did I ask them about, would you be willing to go exchange a needle? I didn't put it in those words. But the information that's being relayed to us is they're not concerned about anything because it's so powerful. This addiction is so powerful. It gets such a hold of them. That is not the person the family members or friends used to see or used to know. They may be there in a shell, but they're not that person. They don't think the same. They don't act the same. And they're definitely not thinking the same.
Joe, how many people does the Rowan County Sheriff's Office employ in terms of officers that are working the streets and out there patrolling and things like that right now?
County Sheriff, we've got a total of 12.
12. Not a very big department. Mm-hmm. How much manpower have you had to allocate for Operation Rowan Roundup on a regular basis?
Well, it's all we can do. We've actually, Chuck, just have one narcotics detective working full-time in that area.
Doesn't sound like it'd be enough.
It's not. It's not. And we're constantly trying to attend these training sessions and seminars and trying to get ideas on what we refer to. We've had to work smarter now instead of trying to go out and enforce with great numbers because we know we can't do that. We're strapped as far as manpower. We're strapped financially. It's all we can do just to keep up with what we're doing now. And we have to, like I said, work smarter. We have to make everything count, every investigation. You know, when Roundup started in 2010, we had a push to go after the street dealers, and we were able to arrest several of those street dealers and bring them in. But, of course, you know, you and I have talked about House Bill 463. It changed the way we did things. In a sense, it minimized some of the drug laws, and it changed the sentences. In a minute, if you want to, we'll go into, talking about, and I don't believe jail is the total answer. It's really not, or incarceration is not the total answer, but it's part of it. And when House Bill 463 came in, we had to change the way we did things. And it's worked. I mean, even though we've changed gears, we've made it work. Instead of the street level, we went after the suppliers and the wholesalers on a bigger scale. But that takes more time. It takes more of an effort. It costs a lot more money. But we've made it work so far. So that's what we've been doing. If you remember back in 2010, our roundups were anywhere from maybe 25 to 30 people at a time. Well, when we do our roundup now, it may be 5, at the most 10, maybe 3. But because we're working,
they're more targeted,
smarter. Yes, and we're going after the ones that's actually bringing it into the dealers.
Yeah, we'll mention House Bill 463 was passed a few years ago.
Yes.
And the idea was that the main idea was to try to relieve the overcrowding at Kentucky's jails and prisons, mm-hmm. because there were so many of these people in there with drug problems. Mm-hmm. What they said basically was that we want to get these people who've been arrested, say, for possession, that mm-hmm. are not a danger to the public, put them through perhaps diversionary programs like treatment.
Yes.
And those people who perhaps are committing small-level crimes to help feed their addictions, or they're out right. there selling drugs to feed their addictions. But that's created some other problems. And in the interest of full disclosure, I will tell people that I was the victim of this very type of situation where I had someone who had been released from a drug violation on the streets, was working in my home, and wound up committing a felony theft, and he was only behind bars 17 hours before he was back out on the street. Mm-hmm. And then he was arrested about a year ago after there were two failure to appear charges against him, where he didn't go to court mm-hmm. to answer the charges against him. And he was found by authorities, then spent finally 11 months in jail. But there's something wrong with that, in my opinion. That shouldn't be happening when someone commits a felony, no matter what the reason is, that they shouldn't be going behind bars.
Right. And that's been our point from the beginning. Unite, Chuck, had I believe, the right approach. It was education, it was treatment, and it was enforcement. I think it's a good three-prong approach. Of course, finances, money, funding, everything, you know, everything's tied to money and funding. So, of course, they're operating just very minimal right now. But we've got to get back to that. We've got to get back to understanding that incarceration, as I mentioned earlier, that it is a part of the process, not the complete answer. But what you've got to do is you've got to separate that addict from their drug of choice for a period of time to let that all get through their system, all those chemicals, everything that's in there. And the reason I say it that way is because even my family member that was involved in this drug epidemic, they told me this. They said, listen, it took 45 days to be behind bars, to be in jail, for me to realize I needed help. From day one to day 44, all I wanted was out of jail. At 45, now, that was just for my family member. I think it varies for different ones. But there has to be some type of reality check. There has to be something that hits home with them that, hey, I don't have to live like this. Now, when they get to that point, they've got to be able to go into some type of treatment facility. They have to be able to go straight into that. And what I've advocated and I think needs to happen is there needs to be treatment facilities that are secure. You go straight from incarceration into a treatment facility that's a secure facility. You work the steps. You work the program like it's supposed to be worked, and you earn your way into freedom. I think if those in place, because a lot of times they go straight from incarceration into a treatment facility that's not secure, and they can walk out whenever. Yeah, it's hanging over their head by a judge's order for them to be there, and yes, a warrant can be issued, but they may be out for who knows how long before we can pick them back up.
And who knows where they go? It may be a long time before you find them again, if you do.
A long time, and they may end up dying before we find them.
Yeah, and this is a problem that has crossed almost all socioeconomic lines. It's not just people in poverty.
No.
It's not bored rich people or rich kids. It crosses the gamut from rich to middle class to the poor. So there's not a pattern from that standpoint that you can follow and say, here's where we need to perhaps look at education or enforcement or things like that.
No boundaries there and no age boundaries. We have incarcerated from teenagers to, I believe, 83, 84 years old that was involved either as a addict or a dealer or a wholesale supplier. So there's no boundaries with this. And Chuck, you probably remember the back years ago we had the DARE program.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not so sure that we shouldn't implement something like that back into our schools.
Why did it go away, Joe? I mean, I thought it was a good program. I thought it sent kids the right message. It at least got them thinking in the right direction, mm-hmm. and they were more knowledgeable about the dangers of drugs and drug abuse.
And it worked. I mean, we had really good feedback from I think the targeted grade was fifth grade, and we had an officer go into the schools, teach drug education, and then after some of those kids had graduated high school into college, they were coming back and telling us what an impact it did make on them. And again, that goes back to that three-pronged approach: education, treatment, and enforcement. I believe that's and we've got to have some major funding in those areas, or we're not even going to scratch the surface with what we're dealing with.
Was it a lack of funding that caused the DARE program to go away, or did people just say, you know, I don't know if this is working or not, we can put these monies into something more effective?
I think it was a combination of things. I think they looked at it, they evaluated it, they were concerned that maybe they wasn't getting the most, they call it bang for their buck in this area. So they kind of pulled back the funding. Of course, the DARE program just kind of folded up at that particular time. We really thought they would bring something back under a different name. Sometimes, you know, we use the word DARE, it may come back under a different title, you know, but it didn't come back that way. But I think something like that has got to be put in place to get the educational part of this out there, and to tell the youth, and to tell even the parents. You know, there could be a part of that program could educate parents.
That's
on
a good
this
idea.
And it can be done. And you know, I don't have all the answers, but from my position and my experience and my time, something has to be done. Something more has to be done if we're going to even attempt to curb what we're facing, because it's getting worse and worse.
And I remember there was a side benefit to this, too, because you got a police officer into the schools mm-hmm. that got to meet these kids, and it was a friendly type of situation, and these kids learned to like police officers,
yes.
as opposed to now we have almost this adversarial attitude in many respects between the police and some people, not all people, not me, for instance, but I think it gave kids the idea that police officers were not the enemy. They're here to help you.
Right. It was so interesting to see. We had, when I was with the Morehead Police Department, we had a DARE officer, Kenny Trent.
Yeah, my daughters had him in school for the DARE program.
And Kenny did such a great job with that DARE program. But it was so amazing to be with Kenny sometimes, and we'd be walking out into the public. We'd be in a store. We'd be out even on the street. And the number of kids that would just run up to him, hug him, give him a high five, you know, that exactly what you're talking about. I walked out to the middle school. We've got a deputy in the middle school and deputy in the high school. And same thing, I walked out there and looked at that. And during breaks, and the deputy would be standing in the hallway, and the kids would come up, and they'd high-five or fist bump them. And, you know, you could see there was some interaction there. And it was a friendly type atmosphere. It wasn't like the deputy standing there guard over them, you know, trying to make them line up. That wasn't it. It was there. A presence was there. But they were there in a friendly setting. And that's what people need to see. We're not all about arresting people. That's part of our job, but that's a small part. We're there to help people, and we're trying to get that message out to our young generation out here. But also, there's parents out there that has kind of missed that also through the years.
And some of the things they might be saying around the household when they watch some of these stories on television or read them perhaps in the newspaper mm-hmm. or hear about them on the radio, there's been a lot made regarding police brutality,
right.
Police shootings, some of it extremely inaccurate, some of it, of course, accurate. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I've always said this. I said 98-99% of the people who are out there wearing a badge are doing the right things. There's always going to be a bad element in
sure.
any area of life, and there are some people out doing the wrong things. But at the same time, when they talk about police officers, they may say something that might catch their kid's ear mm-hmm. and gives them the idea that maybe the police are the enemy.
Yes, that does happen. But we've done a great job over the years in the profession of law enforcement, and it's become a profession to weed out those bad ones. They don't last very long. It's just like anything else. When you're out recruiting and trying to get the best people you can find, and everything's still tied with funding, it's still tied with benefits. The applicant pool is not like it used to be. Of course, you know, we could talk a long time about that. But if somebody's there, not there for the right reasons and not there to help the community, then they pretty well weed themselves out.
Again, our guest today on the front page is Rowan County Chief Deputy Joe Klein. We're going to pause for a moment on the program, come back with more in just a moment.
There are many ways to connect with Morehead State Public Radio. Log on to WMKY.org for enhanced regional news, on-demand audio and video, breaking news from NPR, and information on your favorite programs. Get links to Facebook and Twitter while you listen to our live broadcast online, or download mobile apps from NPR and take 90.3 FM with you everywhere. Connect with your community and Morehead State Public Radio. Visit WMKY.org.
Welcome back to today's front page. I'm Chuck Mraz. Again, we're talking with Rowan County Chief Deputy Joe Klein. Joe, I know that one thing we haven't talked about when we've discussed the drug issue in this area is this heroin pipeline that's running from Detroit into eastern Kentucky. I know they're using bus stations in Lexington and in Ashland to help kind of move their stuff around a little bit and help get it distributed around the area. But this is a difficult problem to solve in terms of shutting this pipeline down because it's multiple people through multi-states. They're not traveling in areas where they feel like there's a lot of security. So how much of a problem is it truly?
Well, it is a major problem. And the one area that you didn't mention there was Cincinnati. You've got Cincinnati, Lexington, and Ashland, Huntington area, which we refer to as that triangle, you know, and it runs right along the interstate, whether it's 64, 75. For whatever reason, Morehead Round County has been a hub of the pills, of the heroin. Could be because of the interstate, the transportation process. It could be because we have a regional medical center. We have a university. For whatever reason, we're kind of a hub. But what we've been able to do is do what we call the push back. We've been able to push it back. Now, when we've done that through this enforcement effort that we're doing, it creates a little a issue for the, I won't say a little, but it creates an issue for the surrounding counties, because a lot of times that's all we're doing is pushing them back in the surrounding counties, and it creates a problem for them. But it goes back to enforcement. If you're enforcing it, they're not going to be in those areas that's, as the street calls it, hot. For an example, we were trying to do a drug buy in Round County, and they said, no, we're not going to do it in Round County. We'll do it in Bath County, or we'll do it in Carter or Elliott. It's too hot in Round County. That itself tells us, what we're doing is we're making a difference out there.
And we want to say this, too. I know that the law enforcement in those counties, they're trying to do their job.
Absolutely.
To the best of their abilities, too. But they're also limited in manpower and money available to do it.
Yes. Well, when you go to these the trainings and the seminars that we've been able to go to and attend, what it ends up being, a networking session of law enforcement across our communities. And when we do push this back, and again, it doesn't just – we're not the only ones doing the push. Some things get pushed over in Round County from these other counties, from Carter, Elliott, or Bath, and it comes into us, then, we're dealing with it too. But it lets us know that everybody's trying to deal with the same problems, the same issues, and some, 12-person department that we have and one narcotics officer, and some of them have more than that, some have not even that. To try to deal with this issue, and of course drug issues, it creates other issues, the theft issues, the burglaries. Again, that addict has a mindset of when, where, and how am I going to get my next hit of heroin. And then of course here lately it's been the mix with heroin fentanyl, which is
extremely dangerous.
And then there's something else that's coming out there. It's called W18 that they're using, W18 or car fentanyl, what it's been referred to. And it's an elephant tranquilizer. That's what they use it to tranquilize elephants. And they're cutting this with heroin. And one hit will shut the body down.
That's amazing. I mean, yes. I didn't know that. And it's also not only amazing but extremely scary. There are people out there that are willingly buying this, not knowing what's in it.
Absolutely.
So what do you do? I mean, as we move forward, you talked about education, enforcement, and treatment. I mean, but at the same time, I guess you've got to get a handle on that enforcement part of it so you can get the other parts to work.
It's constantly what I refer to as a chess game. We're constantly playing the chess game, trying to plan our next move. And when we make this move, what's the counter move going to be? And that's the way it's been with the drug trafficking. They're watching what we're doing, then they adjust. We watch what they're doing, and we adjust. Of course, our big thing, and I'm glad we do it the way we do it, is we got to play by the rules they don't. We got to play by what the law says within the law, and we have to operate within the law. And a lot of times that's what takes so long for us to do our investigation, is because we've got to make sure that everything lines up with the way the law tells us we have to. Otherwise, they're going to take it to court, and it's going to be dismissed or thrown out, or they're going to be found not guilty if we don't do our job exactly the way the law tells us we've got to do it. And that's what we do. We enforce the law, and we go by the law. It's a major issue, a major problem that we're facing. It's not going to get any better. And we've got to adjust. It's like the old saying, Chuck, if we're dealt lemons, we've got to make lemonade. And that's what we've got to do. We've got to take and make this as positive as we can. And I think it's going to take a education, a treatment, and an enforcement effort. We've got to get legislators on board. We've got to get our message out through, we've got to have the ear of the lawmakers and saying we've got to have help in the funding area of combating this major problem that we're dealing with.
Joe, thanks so much for being with us on Front Page.
You're welcome, Chuck. Thank you.
Rowland County Chief Deputy Joe Klein. I'm Chuck Morales on Front Page. See you next time.